As we discussed in lesson 12, which was where we looked at chapter 8, today we're going to be looking at chapter 10, but back in lesson 12 we looked at chapter 8. And as we discussed there, some commentators see chapter 8 as Paul agreeing with the Corinthians that some of them had the right to eat in an idol's temple. But those commentators have a big problem when they get to chapter 10. Because in chapter 10, Paul is very clearly going to prohibit that activity. So, well, how do they explain their discrepancy then that they have between what they say about chapter 8 and what they say about chapter 10? And some say, well, chapter 8 is to a different audience than chapter 10. They say chapter 8 is to the strong and chapter 10 is to the weak. There are some problems with that view. We talked about some of them in chapter 12. We'll talk about some of them today. Others say, well, you know, chapter 10 doesn't really belong in this letter. That's a different letter. That's an earlier, more Jewish letter that Paul wrote. And he changed his mind. And then somehow they all got mixed together and we all have... No, that's just ridiculous. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 all have the same message or in the same letter. And there's no contradiction there. The best explanation for the discrepancy is that there is no discrepancy. Chapters 8 through 10 all belong to this letter. They all have the same basic message about idolatry, and that is flee idolatry, we'll see in this chapter. Let's start looking then at chapter 10. Paul's use of the phrase, our fathers, in verse 1 is very important. He clearly regards his Corinthian converts, both Jew and Gentile, to be the sons and daughters of those whom God dealt with in the Old Testament. You know, Gentiles may be wild olive shoots, as Paul says elsewhere, Romans 11, but they have been grafted in, and now they're part of that tree. Paul's entire argument here is based on the presupposition that the Corinthian Christians stand in continuity with what God has done in the past, that wasn't just a Jewish thing in the Old Testament. You know, as you recall, the issue of eating idol meat is a Gentile problem. No Jew would ever be caught dead in an idol's temple. This is a problem with the Gentile converts. And yet here is Paul looking back to the Old Testament and saying, our fathers, Paul the Jew speaking to the Gentiles. You know, we need to also see the Old Testament biblical history as a history of our fathers. And not simply the history of the father of the Jews, the fathers of the Jews. The Old Testament is a Christian book because Christ is on every page. He's the prime actor. He's the final goal. And certainly it contains many warnings, as Paul is going to say here in his discussion of it. You know, this was very different from Jewish proselytes when Gentiles converted over to Judaism. They were explicitly taught not to pray our God and the God of our fathers. They were taught to pray our God and the God of their fathers. And Paul said, that's not the way it is in the church. The Old Testament patriarchs are our fathers. In verses 1 through 4, Paul listed the spiritual blessings that were enjoyed by the Jews during the Exodus. Verse 1, they were all under the cloud. You know, the word all is repeated 5 times in these verses. Paul is emphasizing this is something they all experienced. I think he may be trying to preempt the argument. Well, yeah, you know, Paul, a lot of people fell in the wilderness, but they were the weak. They may not have gotten these blessings. You know, they may not have been as spiritual. No, Paul is saying they all got these blessings. And, of course, that also should tell us that Paul is not talking to a subset here in chapter 10. He's not just talking to the weak. He starts off by saying all, when he looks back at the Old Testament. I think he's talking to all of the church here. The cloud denoted God's protection. Psalm 105:30 described it as a covering, covered the people. They all passed through the sea. I think that blessing, of course, recalls their deliverance as they passed through the sea on dry ground. Verse 2, they were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. You know, Paul begins here to compare God's deliverance of the Jews with God's deliverance of the Corinthians. The Jews were delivered when they passed through water, leaving their bondage behind, and leaving the idolatry of Egypt behind also. You know, Peter in 1 Peter 3:20 and 21 makes a very similar argument, not with the Exodus, but with the flood, that they also passed through water and were saved. And Peter likens that to our own baptism. when we combine Paul's example here with Peter's example and with all the rest that the Bible says about baptism, the result is inescapable. Our baptism marks the beginning of our new life. It marks the point of our deliverance. When we pass through the waters of baptism, that's when the new life begins. Isn't that what Romans 6:4 tells us? That's when we begin to walk in newness of life. The Jews' new life began when they crossed the Red Sea. Noah and his family, their new life began when they crossed through the floodwaters. Our new life begins in our baptism. And I think that's the point that Paul is emphasizing with the Corinthians. Corinthians, your new life began at your baptism, just like the Exodus when they passed through the water. And Peter would have said, just like the flood when Noah passed through the water. And that was the permanent boundary. That sea, that the Red Sea, was the boundary between Egypt, bondage, idolatry, and their new life. And that we also have a boundary. And I think that's the point Paul is about to drive home with these Corinthians. Why are you still dabbling in idolatry if you've crossed the boundary? You've been baptized. Paul's illustrations here lay the groundwork for his argument. All Israel experienced God's saving deliverance under Moses, but they all did not reach the final goal. Why? Because of their flagrant sin, because of their idolatry. That's why they didn't reach the final goal. They were all blessed. Paul has just listed their blessings. But those blessings did not exempt them from God's judgment when they disobeyed Him, when they went back into idolatry. Paul's entire argument here is that the Corinthians are in danger of doing the exact same thing. You look back and see what the Jews did. Wonderful blessings, wonderful deliverance, and they went back into idolatry. Paul's message to the Corinthians is, you need to read that very carefully because you're in danger of doing the same thing. Egypt held the Jews in bondage, and Egypt was full of idolatry. The Jews left that behind. They left that idolatry behind. Paul is telling the Corinthians, you too need to have left that behind when you passed through the waters of baptism. Verses 3 through 4. They ate the same spiritual meat, drank the same spiritual drink. Not only did the Jews have a blessing that was analogous to baptism, they had something analogous to the Lord's Supper. Paul identifies the gift of manna as the spiritual bread and the water from the rock as the spiritual drink. The drink came from the rock that followed them, verse 4 says, and that rock was Christ. The statement that the rock followed them is puzzling. The Old Testament doesn't say anything about the rock traveling with them, from which they continued to draw their water. But, the text does lend itself to that inference. So the rock is mentioned twice. Once at the beginning of their journey in Exodus 17 and once near the end in Numbers 20. And with 40 years of wandering in between, God must have provided them water at other times as well. One commentator noted that if the rock of Exodus 17 is also the rock of Numbers 20, and if they're one and the same, then the rock had to have followed them. In any event, Paul here is writing, of course, under inspiration. I think that settles the question. I think the rock did follow them. And that point has an important theological implication for Paul here. The following rock denotes God's continued graciousness, His continued blessings all throughout their wilderness journey. And that divine source of spiritual blessings, Paul says, was Christ. Well, what does that mean, that the rock was Christ? Well, rock, of course, was a title used for God in the Old Testament. In the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32, which in many ways forms a foundation for what Paul is saying here. You see the rock of salvation, the rock that begot you, our rock and my Redeemer, all applicable to God, and of course equally applicable to Christ. You know, Deuteronomy 32:15 describes someone who went back into idolatry. You know what it says? It says they forsook God and lightly esteemed the rock of their salvation. And I think Paul's message is clear. That's the danger the Corinthians are in. They're forsaking God and lightly esteeming Christ, the rock of their salvation. Verse 5. Deliverance from Egypt did not mean final deliverance. Israel had to pass through a time of testing in the wilderness before they could ever enter the promised land. You know, in the same way, the deliverance of a Christian does not mean they're whisked away to safety and they don't have any kind of perilous journey to undertake. No, we face the same kind of dangers, the same kind of temptations in our own pagan wilderness that we're wandering through, that the Israelites experienced in their Exodus. You know, the word "but" in verse 5, I think that reveals that what happened to Israel was counter to what you would have expected. They were so greatly blessed. They had been rescued from Egypt. They had been taken across dry land and passed through the water and all the blessings. And they were so richly blessed. But God was not pleased with most of them, which of course is an understatement since only two, Joshua and Caleb, actually made it into the promised land. The others were overthrown in the wilderness. The Greek there is literally, they were strewn about in the wilderness. Very graphic. Despite all the spiritual benefits that they enjoyed, they did not reach Canaan. Why? Because of their post-baptismal sins. Whereby post-baptismal, it means after they had passed through the Red Sea. It's all that happened after that. They weren't denied entry into the Promised Land because of something they did back in Egypt. They were denied entry into the Promised Land because of what they did during the wilderness journey, after their deliverance from Egypt. In verse 6, Paul links the divine blessings in verses 1 through 4 with the subsequent punishments for disobedience. Those events happened as examples. The Greek word there is hypos, and it refers to a mold for producing a shape or a wooden stamp to imprint into clay. That's the kind of example that we have here. And they're intended to guide us. You know, if we make the same mistakes, then we can expect the same results. You know, if you've ever taken a physics class, you've probably seen a video of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapse in 1940. A very famous video of the bridge just going crazy and collapsing into the bridge. And you know, that bridge was a real source of civic pride back then. And after its collapse, the governor of Washington got on the radio, because they were all very worried about it, and he said, "The state will build the exact same bridge in the exact same way in the exact same place." And an engineering professor wrote him a letter. He said, "You know, Governor, if you build the exact same bridge in the exact same way, in the exact same place, it's going to fall down into the exact same river in the exact same way." And so they didn't build it the exact same way. They built another bridge, one that wouldn't have that problem. And that's kind of the Old Testament. I think that's Paul's message here. Corinthians, you're doing the exact same thing in the exact same way. Are you expecting a different result? Paul wants the Corinthians to heed the warnings of Scripture. They've left the starting block as the elect of God, but they're not yet in the promised land. They, like Israel, have a wilderness journey. They have dangers all around them. All around them. And they, like Israel, are not going to be exempt from God's judgment simply because they've received these great blessings. They, like Israel, can fall. Well, what were the Israelites' problems? First and foremost, they were cravers after evil. When the Israelites grew tired of the spiritual manna and began to grumble, God sent them quail to eat. But before they could even swallow a bite of quail, God sent them a plague, a great plague, because of their grumbling, because they had turned their back on the spiritual food, the manna. Numbers 11:33-34 describes the situation, and it says, after the plague, that they buried them in the place called Kibroth Hattaavah. And what does that mean? It means graves of craving. Graves of craving. They craved evil and they were buried in graves of craving. And Paul connects that craving after evil by the Israelites with the Corinthians craving to eat that meat in those idol temples. Verse 7. In the next five verses, Paul outlines four of Israel's transgressions that resulted from this basic sin of craving, and that broke their relationship with God. Idolatry, harlotry, putting Christ to the test, and grumbling. You know, Paul is not simply listing or compiling a catalog of sins here. He's listing sins that specifically apply to the Corinthian situation. Of the four warnings from the wilderness here, verse 7 contains the only explicit quotation from Scripture. Exodus 32, second half of verse 6. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Why does Paul highlight that verse? It's interesting, he doesn't cite a verse emphasizing their worship and their sacrifice to the golden calf as, for example, the first half of verse 6 in Exodus 32 does. He cites the second half of that verse that says they were eating and drinking and playing. I think the text indicates that the people ate and drank in the presence of that golden calf. In fact, Aaron said, "Let us have a feast to the Lord." And then they built the golden calf and had that feast. I think they ate that food right in the presence of that golden calf. And I think that is Paul's point here. He wants to drive home the fact that they were willingly participating in idolatry by eating and drinking right there in front of the idol, just like the Old Testament the Jews were doing in front of that golden calf. In verse 8, Paul says, "Let us not commit fornication." You know, the phrase "rose up to play" in Exodus 32:6, that's a euphemism. It has sexual overtones. And I think Paul's exhortation against immorality in verse 8, I think it may indicate that the Corinthians dabbling with idolatry in that idol temple may have also involved sexual sin. And we know he's already dealt with the prostitution and fornication in chapter 6. But Paul's warning here may also refer to more of a metaphorical idolatry, because, you know, when the Israelites left and went back to idolatry, they were accused of harlotry. They were turning their back on God and becoming a harlot. That's how the Old Testament would describe that. Paul is probably alluding here to Numbers 25. And that recounts the people having sexual relations with the women of Moab and being invited to sacrifice to their gods. And verse 2 of Numbers 25 tells us the people ate and bowed down to their gods. They ate and bowed down to their gods. And verse 9 tells us God sent a plague that killed 24,000 people. But, you know, there we have a problem, because Numbers 25 tells us 24,000 died. And Paul, in verse 8, tells us 23,000 died. Well, is that a contradiction? Nope. First, if we're going to get nitpicky about 23 versus 24, then we might expect to be nitpicked in return. So let me start off with that point. We should note that Paul doesn't tell us here that only 23,000 died. And if 24,000 perished, then it must be the case that 23,000 perished. Second, any reasonable person is going to understand that most of the large numerical figures in the Old Testament regarding casualties are estimates, just as they are today. If a newspaper tells us this morning that 7,000 people were killed by an Indonesian earthquake, and then we wake up the next day and find out that 6,712 really died, are we going to write the editor, say, "Why did you lie to us?" No, we understand that it's estimates. And I think that certainly was the case in the Old Testament with regard to the mass casualty figures. But, you know, Paul may have had a theological reason for taking the 24,000 and lopping off 1,000 and instead saying 23,000. Exodus 32 forms the backdrop for most of his warnings here against idolatry. He just quoted verse 6 of that chapter and verse 7 of chapter 10 here. Exodus 32, verse 28 says 3,000 idolaters died at the hands of the Levites. I think Paul may have wanted to connect in their mind the Numbers 25 example we just saw with 24,000 with the 3,000 that died in Exodus 32, and he put those together to get 23,000 to teach them a spiritual lesson. That's a possibility also. And there's a lot of other commentators giving additional possibilities. Those are the three that I think are probably the best. Verse 9, Paul warns the Corinthians not to tempt Christ, as some of the Jews did and were destroyed by serpents. Paul's message here is simple. The Corinthians' participation in idol meals at idol temples violates their covenant relationship with Christ, just as the Jews violated their covenant relationship with God by turning to those false gods and those false idols. You know, the serpents mentioned here recalled Numbers 21, where the people spoke against God and against Moses and expressed their annoyance with the menu and the lack of water, and serpents were sent. You know, the word "test," though, doesn't appear there in Numbers 21 as it does here, but it does appear in the psalmist summary of that incident, which occurs in Psalm 78, verse 18. "And they tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust." There we have tempting God, There we have meat. There we have craving. All the concepts we're looking at here in one verse, Psalm 78, verse 18, describing that same event that Paul is looking at here. Verse 10, the murmuring and grumbling in verse 10 there really characterizes that entire wilderness experience. You know, you think back on the Exodus, and if there's one theme that ran throughout, it was murmuring and grumbling. They would just do that over and over again. The destroyer mentioned there, maybe the destroying angel mentioned in Exodus 12:23, could refer to Satan, but it may refer to that destroying angel in Exodus 12:23. And if that's true, the picture is particularly striking, that destroying angel that gave them their deliverance before they passed through the Red Sea, that same destroyer was now coming when they sinned and turned their back on God, that same destroying angel. The litany of Israel's sins in Psalm 106, I think, may provide the best backdrop for understanding the reference to grumbling that we see here. And Paul's discussion here has noticeable vocabulary similarities with Psalm 106. We have craving, putting God to the test, grumbling, fornication as a figurative reference to idolatry, and we have God's threat to destroy them. You know, Psalm 106 also lists idolatry and eating food offered to an idol and its condemnation of Israel's apostasy. In the psalm, their destruction is related to their grumbling. I think Paul is looking back to that psalm as he lists these sins here. And you know, I think Paul may have singled out grumbling for a reason, because they were grumbling against him. You know, the Old Testament doesn't say they were just grumbling against God. They also grumbled against Moses. And I think the people here were grumbling against Paul. And they may have been grumbling against Paul because of his hard line on this idol food issue. Verse 11, these events were recorded for our admonition. And you know, the events happened by way of example for us. That's what Paul tells us there. And Paul also tells us something else very important here. And that is that the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. God did not suddenly become lax in punishing transgression. In fact, you know, if anything is true, the opposite is true. Not because God has changed, but because we now know so much more. So much more has been revealed to us. We stand with so much more knowledge. I think we have so much more responsibility that we can pick up our Bible and see the whole plan of God from A to Z and read it and study it and understand it. We have so much more responsibility. And we think God is now going to become lax in His punishment of transgression and disobedience. The Corinthians had ignored the warning siren blaring from the Old Testament. They just ignored it. They'd ignored the accounts of Israel's apostasy and the results that that caused, despite the blessing they'd received in their deliverance from Egypt. They had ignored all of that. If the wilderness generation met such a terrible end for spurning a concealed Christ, how much more will the Corinthians be punished? And how much more will we be punished if we spurn a revealed Christ? The ends of the ages. It says the ends of the ages have arrived. The plural ends there, a lot of commentators have spent a lot of ink on that one. It may refer to two strands of time, not really a temporal end, but it may be that the end of the Jewish age, think of it like a string with two ends, that the end of the Jewish age meets the end of the Christian age, where the Christian age then also has two ends, like a string does. That's possible. Another possibility is that there are really two strands of time running in the Old Testament. God's dealing with the Jews, and that had an end. And God's dealing with the Gentiles, and that had an end. And those two ends have also arrived. So it could mean either of those two things, I believe. Verse 12, wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. You know, these Corinthian know-it-alls needed to watch, not only because they might cause others to fall, because they might fall themselves. Their presumed knowledge and spiritual sophistication had led them to risk idolatrous associations and then think nothing of it, as if it really meant nothing. They were oblivious to the fact that they were in dire spiritual jeopardy by dabbling with idols. there was something there they should flee, and they were playing around with it like it's really nothing at all. Paul sounds the alarm here against these pagan banquets that must have seemed so trivial to Corinthians. Oh, they're just innocent social gatherings. And yeah, they have a little religious mumbo-jumbo now and then, but it means nothing to us. We know. We have knowledge. We're sophisticated. You know, if Paul thought he could fall, as he said at the end of chapter 9, verse 27, how much more then could the Corinthians fall? No one is immune from falling. No one. And those who think they are immune from falling, I think, are in the greatest danger of falling. Verse 13 has been called undoubtedly one of the most difficult verses in the entire epistle. It's probably the one that we're most familiar with. The usual interpretation here has it referring to our internal struggles with sin and that God will find a way of escape. And I'm certainly not saying it does not apply to that. But rather than belabor that familiar interpretation, let's look at another possibility. Another perhaps broader meaning, and that is that perhaps Paul here has in mind an external testing, a persecution from the outside. The verb to bear up under appears two other times in the New Testament in the context of persecution. 2 Timothy 3:11, 1 Peter 2:19. The testing may involve not just our allurements to idolatry, that'd be the internal temptation, but it may also involve the persecution that the rejection of idolatry brought to these Corinthians. Avoiding all overt associations with idolatry would have invited a lot of hostility from their pagan friends. Their host would have seen it as a big insult that they no longer would eat the food after its source was announced. If the host was their patron or their employer, it could have had severe financial retribution. You know, those who refused to offer a pinch of incense to Caesar were not allowed to enter the trade guilds, and they suffered tremendous economic hostility. And if you want to see more about that, read the first few chapters of Revelation about the letter to the churches. It talks about that. And how easily they could have rationalized this all away. God doesn't want me to lose my job, does he? How am I going to give money to the church if that happens? How am I going to spread the gospel if I can't go have dinner with my pagan friends? Surely God doesn't want... You know, the gospel is one thing, but this is business, Paul. This is important. You can just see them trying to rationalize this all away. They no doubt thought they were going to be traumatized beyond repair if Paul did not let them go and eat in the idol temple. And I think Paul's message here is that their refusal will not result in any external testing or persecution that God will not help them endure. As surely as God tests, he provides a way out. But you know, that way out is not an escape hatch that allows them to avoid all the difficulties. If that were true, then why would it be necessary for God to provide some way for them to bear up under it, if he just whisked them away so they don't even have to worry about that anymore? The trials may be severe, but Paul tells them they're common to man. The Corinthians' experience here was not unique. And in fact, you know, history tells us that other Christians at this time, elsewhere, were suffering much worse trials than this, than the Corinthians were suffering by not participating in idol meals. God is faithful, it tells us. But those who compromise with the world can expect not divine aid, but divine destruction. God is just as faithful to destroy the wicked as he is faithful to save the righteous. Let's move into the second section, starting in verses 14 through 22. Verse 14, flee idolatry. Paul opens this section of his argument against idol food with a direct command that is the climactic conclusion of all his previous discussions on this subject, and that is, flee idolatry. The address, my dearly beloved, here, I think, denotes a genuine affection for the Corinthians. He stresses that bond before he reloads and fires a direct shot with the command, flee idolatry. His love and his concern for them has not dimmed in the slightest, despite their attacks against him, and despite the vigor with which he has had to argue with them in this letter. You know, verse 14, I think, gives the fundamental mandate going all the way back to chapter 8 that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. You know, it matches the prohibition, flee fornication, that we saw in chapter 6, verse 18. And what did that follow?
That followed Paul's theological discussion of sexual sins, starting all the way back in chapter 5. You know, the parallels here in this letter are just remarkable. And, you know, you read these commentators that take 1 Corinthians and just slice it and dice it and do about 1,000 different letters. You read it, look at it. It's so beautiful, the parallels in Paul's arguments here. Here in verse 14 of chapter 10, flee idolatry. Back in chapter 6, flee fornication. Here in chapter 10, the Lord's Supper represents that we are one body with Christ. Back in chapter 6, your bodies are members of Christ. Here in chapter 10, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. Back in chapter 6, all things are lawful, not all things are helpful. Here in chapter 10, verse 31, do all to the glory of God. Back in chapter 6, glorify God in your body. The parallels are just remarkable between Paul's discussion of fornication and his discussion of idolatry. As a union with a prostitute is unthinkable for a Christian, so becoming a partner at the table of demons is equally unthinkable. And Paul makes both of those arguments. You know, some commentators and translations try to downplay the meaning of flee here and flee idolatry. The Revised Standard Version, for example, says, shun idols. Paul is not urging shunning. Paul is urging active fleeing. It's unthinkable that you would be situated there at a table with demons. And Paul is saying, run, flee, active fleeing, not just shunning. Idolatry is like radioactive waste. It requires you to bolt from the area immediately to avoid contamination and certain death. That's the message Paul has with regard to idolatry. Chapter 8 must be interpreted in light of chapter 10, particularly verse 14. If we conclude that chapter 8 has Paul saying that some people are strong enough to go eat in an idol's temple, how do we reconcile this in verse 14 of chapter 10? Flee idolatry. Are we also going to conclude that Paul thought some people were strong enough to have sexual relations with a prostitute? No. Verse 15. Some see irony in verse 15 about the wise, but I think a better view is that Paul truly believed these Corinthians were wise enough to see the illogic of their behavior, to discern the truth. And that's why Paul is arguing with them on this point. He wants to reason with them so they will see the illogic of their arguments. In the next 7 verses, he's going to ask 7 rhetorical questions, each inviting their thoughtful response. And he goes through the list. Verses 16 through 17. Paul appeals to the Lord's Supper, and he wants to show that he wants to compare it and contrast it to idol meals. He wants to say, you know, it's similar, but it's the opposite. That's how he wants to compare and contrast the Lord's Supper. It's similar because each builds a bond between the participants and the honored deity. That's how they're similar. But of course, they're opposite because the Lord's Supper is building a bond with the one true God, and the idol meal is building a bond with the demons. That's the difference. That's the huge difference. Paul makes 3 points here about the Lord's Supper that directly apply to idol meals. First, partaking of the Lord's Supper creates a fellowship with Christ. And in the same way, partaking of that idol meal is going to create a fellowship with that false god, with that demon that stands behind the false god. He also says partaking of the Lord's Supper creates a fellowship with your fellow partakers. Look at the number of times he says, we do this, we give thanks, we take the bread. It's building fellowship with your fellow partakers. And Paul's point there is that in that idol meal, you're building fellowship with the fellow pagans that are sitting there celebrating that false god. And of course, third, he emphasizes the blood of Christ, which is the basis for the covenant relationship we have with Christ. It tells the importance of that covenant and what we are spurning if we turn our back and go to an idol meal. You know, I think Paul's point here is that the Lord's Supper is not just part of a progressive dinner where you can go to the Lord's Supper in church and partake of that and then go to the next stage and partake of the idol meal over here. And that's not the way it works at all. It's a very meaningful meal for Christians, and we cannot partake of that and partake of some farce of a Lord's Supper, but with demons. I mean, it's just unthinkable to Paul, and that's the point he's making here. Verse 18, behold Israel after the flesh, are not they which eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? Well, the issue here is which altar Paul has in mind. Is he speaking of the altar in the Jewish temple, Or is he still speaking of the altar in the Exodus, perhaps the one in front of the golden calf? If you look back at Exodus 32, 5 through 6, you'll see that Aaron built an altar before that golden calf. I think the context favors that as the option. Particularly, he said Israel after the flesh. I think that's referring back to the idolatrous, sinful experiences back during the Exodus, which is certainly the context here. Verses 19 through 22. Unlike his questions in verses 16 and 18, Paul's question here expects a negative response. Paul's anticipating an objection. How can a bond be established with an idol when an idol is nothing? It doesn't even exist. How can I have a bond with something that doesn't even exist? And Paul says, you know those idols, they may not exist, but there's something behind those idols that's very, very real. Demons, they stand behind those idols. You know, it's been said the devil's greatest wile is to persuade men that he does not exist. I don't see how anybody watching the 10 o'clock news could think that A, Satan does not exist, and B, that he's not very active in this world today. And he stood behind these idol temples. Paul does not want them to be partakers with demons. And it's not just a risk that this might occur, as some commentators say. Paul's saying it will occur. You go into that idol temple, you partake of that idol meal, you're going to be partaking that with a demon. That was Paul's message here. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than He is? That's not an ironic question to the so-called strong. Paul is including himself in those questions. He's addressing all Christians, including himself. The references to God's jealousy in the Old Testament generally has to do with idol worship. That God is a jealous God. He does not want them to worship these false gods. And I think Paul is making the same point here. Are we trying to make God jealous by partaking of the Lord's Supper and then running off to an idol temple? Let's look at the third section, meat sold in the marketplace, starting in verse 23. And Paul here returns to that issue of liberty that was raised all the way back in chapter 8. Some in the church assume their knowledge about idols gave them the liberty to eat in an idol's temple. And they supported their view, no doubt, with the maxim, all things are lawful, which we also saw in chapter 6, verse 12, which we discussed at length in that lesson. And Paul, of course, reminded them that has limits. That phrase has limits. And he's going to remind them of that here also. You know, one commentator said, those who take advantage of everything that is lawful rapidly deteriorate into doing what is not lawful. And I think that was going on here. They were taking advantage of something that was lawful, which was buying meat in the marketplace. And Paul's going to talk about that. But they were then taking that to an extreme and beginning to do something that was not lawful, which was eating meat in an idol's temple. Verses 25 through 27. You know, avoiding all food that had any association with an idol was a tall order. Because food purchased in the market or served in a friend's home could easily have come from an idolatrous rite. And we talked about that in chapter 12, how that food was prepared and how it made its way into the marketplace. But, you know, that did not mean that all meat carried that taint. You know, we talked, I think, a couple lessons ago about it's pretty high probability that if you bought meat in an idol out in the marketplace, it would come from an idol, but that was not 100%. They've excavated a butcher shop in Pompeii. And in that butcher shop, they found entire skeletons of sheep. If those sheep had come from an idol's temple, they would not have been an entire skeleton. Part of it would have remained for the priest. So that tells you those butcher shops had some meat from idol temples, but they had other meat that did not come from an idol temple. Well, Paul, why didn't you tell the Corinthian Christians then to go in and start quizzing that butcher? Where did this come from? What about this? Are you sure this didn't touch that? Has this been close to that? Where did it... No. God did not call us to be meat inspectors. That is not the purpose here. And once that meat has left the orbit of that idol temple, then it's fine. God made it. Buy it, eat it, enjoy it, be thankful for it. It's from God. It's left the orbit, the sphere of that idol temple. You don't know where it came from, except that it came from God, because God made it. So enjoy it, be thankful for it, eat it. Commentators are split over whether the conscience in verse 25 is that of the purchasers or perhaps that of a weaker observer that was watching this. I think it's probably that of the purchaser. In short, don't overstress your own conscience. Don't start asking a bunch of questions. If you don't know where it came from and no one has raised the issue, fine. It came from God. eat it, enjoy it, be thankful for it. You know, some look at verse 27 and say, well, ha-ha, that doesn't refer to a private home. That refers to a feast in an idol temple. No. How could it? Paul is saying that you don't know where the food came from. If you're sitting there in the idol temple, don't you know where the food came from? It came from the idol temple. You're sitting right there and eating it in the idol temple. Of course it was sacrificed to an idol. I think this is a feast or a banquet in a private home or a private facility where you don't know where that food came from. Verses 29 through 30. There are limits, though, to what a Christian could eat. What Paul finds sinful is eating food in any setting that might give the slightest indication that Christians sanctioned idolatry. Eating food in an idol temple always gives that impression. Always. Eating food in a private setting or buying food in the marketplace sometimes gives that impression. If anyone declares that the meat has the slightest religious significance, then the Christians must abstain. By knowingly partaking of idol food, they would be tacitly condoning idolatry and lending support to their adversaries. Paul instructs them not to eat because of the one who made the disclosure and because of conscience. And he clarifies in verse 29, he means the conscience of the one who made the announcement, not that of the believer who served the meal. Most assume here that conscience harkens back to the weak conscience in chapter 8. It's a possibility, but it may just be the person's consciousness that he knows where it came from. You don't know, but this other person, he has consciousness of where it came from. He knows the source of that. The general food is that the food's history does not, the general rule is that the food's history does not matter. But an exception occurs when the food's history matters to someone who considers it sacred. In that situation, it's not what the Christian knows that counts. It's what this other person believes. If a Christian were to eat idol meat in that situation, it would have at least three harmful effects. It would compromise their confession of the one true God because they're dabbling in idolatry. It would confirm rather than challenge the pagan's conviction about that meat. And it would make the Christians appear hypocritical in their condemnation of idolatry. You know, they should have seen that as an opportunity to stand up and say, let me tell you about the one true God. And you know, we're faced with opportunities like that every day, where we have an opportunity, where we could go on and nothing is raised, but then someone raises a religious point, or they say this date has a religious significance it does not have, or this idol, or these beads, or something. And boy, that's an opportunity for us. To stand up and say, no, that's not true. Let me tell you about that. And I think Paul here is saying, you know, this should be an opportunity for you to abstain and to make a point with these pagans. In the second half of verse 29, Paul asks, why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience? And in verse 30, he asks, for if by grace I be a partaker, why am I evil spoken of for that which I give thanks? These two rhetorical questions have been called the major stumbling blocks in understanding the flow of Paul's arguments here. And for my co-teacher, who always complained about getting the tough chapters, chapter 10 has some tough passages in it. Some see them here as Paul defending himself against his own past actions. Like maybe he had partaken of some of this, and now he's standing up and saying, why are you speaking of evil of me? I don't think that's the case. Having studied it and looked at the commentary, my opinion, my view, is that these verses follow from verse 27, with verse 28 being kind of a parenthetical interruption in the argument here. Paul allows the Christians to attend the dinner without asking questions on the ground of conscience. He then interrupts that thought with a parenthetical observation that they are to abstain if someone announces where the food came from. But then I think he returns to his original thought here and explains why conscience does not matter if you don't know where the food came from. I think that's probably the best explanation for these two admittedly difficult verses. Finally, verses 31 through 33, the ultimate aim of a Christian is to please God. And boy, if we understand that, then doesn't the rest of this just all fall into place? The word all in verse 31 completely excludes the possibility that a Christian can compartmentalize his life and have a part over here where he tries to please God and have a part over here where he does what he pleases. No. We please God in all that we do. All that we do. And boy, doesn't that explain the starting point here. All things are permissible. Yes, if we are pleasing God in all things that we do. Paul's concern here is much broader than some internal squabble in the church. The issue of idol food, he started with in chapter 8, directly affects the church's ability to spread the gospel. And that's always the case when the church begins to compromise with the world and forgets that it's in the business of pleasing God and glorifying God. Thank you for your attention. Next week, chapter 11.